Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. I think we've got a great show for you. Most of our Drug Truth regulars are filing their reports today. And to kick it off, we're going to start with an interview I did with Dr. Rick Doblin. He's the president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Rick, we just returned from the Long Beach Drug Policy Alliance Conference. Tell us your feelings. What was expressed there? Where are we going?
Well, I think I feel there, and I've been going to these kind of conferences for about 20 years, and I feel that there's a spirit of connection and the broadening of the message that hasn't existed before, a sense of optimism, and at the same time, a recognition of how difficult it's going to be, how long it's going to be. But still, to have watched from where there really was no police support to where there's an organization, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, that has about more than several thousand members and was well represented at the conference. So it's not just this fringe group anymore that's trying to talk about drug legalization just because they're fighting the 60s still. It's really broadened, and this conference felt like it had, there was people from more different perspectives and more mature in terms of having worked in this area for a long time. The interconnections of the people, the conference speakers were tremendous, the topics were really well covered. I think there's a sense that the larger funders are still supporting this movement, that there needs to be a lot more funding, but that there is more support coming in, and the strategies are maturing, the skills are maturing, we're moving more into kind of electoral victories, not just complaining, more lobbyists, more official supporters from the Mayor of Salt Lake City. I think that there's just a sense that in many different ways, this whole culture of extremism that we have in America, not always, often bipartisan, particularly as it has been applying to the drug war, to the sense of the culture wars, that it's weakening, that the old fear messages, they still work, but they don't work as well. There's more opportunities to talk about the promise. There's more sense of the wastefulness and racism and destructiveness of the drug war and the extremes they have to go to in order to block scientific research that might contradict the propaganda. There's this sense that there's more scientific research going on now and more potential for it.
There was a maturing, as you say. I think people are now willing to talk about and use the word legalize. Your thoughts on that?
I have long felt that it's best to say what we're after, and even though initially people are uncomfortable with it, at least you've informed them where you're at, and then over time, you're building up credibility. They don't think you're trying to sneak something up on them, and so I think we need to come out and say, legalization, yes, but what does that mean? It's always been the image, legalization, has been conjured by the prohibitionists to mean kids going and getting crack from a vending machine. High school kids getting crack from a vending machine. That's sort of the extreme of what, prohibitionists try to paint the picture of legalization. But on the other hand, I think we should say legalization, it means legal. It means yes, adults get it. Then we can talk about how and in which ways. And we could even say that we want ways that are more rigorous right now than what we have for alcohol. I think that there should be licenses for purchasing drugs, just like there's licenses for driving a car. And if you lose the license, if you misbehave and hurt somebody while you're using a drug, you should lose the license to buy it, just like drunk drivers should have a more difficult time getting alcohol, not just losing their driver's license. So I think then we could talk about, I think we have to say, though, out front, there's a principle here. The principle is adults should be able to have these opportunities, and society should both educate, do harm reduction, and there should be a certain amount of personal responsibility here, too. On the other hand, I think that for minors, not only should we talk about legalization, but I think there's this growing sense that, and it's still in a minority, way minority, but I think there's this growing sense that we need to really be direct about how do we deal with the kids. And I think the first thing we need to say is that it's a family matter. It's not a matter of the government. And the family should be able to educate children. And in 23 states, it's legal for parents to give alcohol to their kids. That's the model we need for when marijuana is legal. Parents should have that right to educate their kids at their discretion. And I think that's the principle. It's a family values principle, and it solves so much because it permits teaching about moderation. If there's no teaching about moderation, how do you expect kids to consume things in moderation once they start college and nobody's around, or they leave home and nobody's around? You've got to have education through the family.
Many of our listeners might not be aware of MAPS, your organization. Please tell them a bit about that and the work you do.
Sure. The MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, you can see us on the web at MAPS, MAPS.org. It's basically, at its core, a psychedelic and medical marijuana nonprofit pharmaceutical company. And so we're boldly going where no pharmaceutical company has gone before or wants to go, which is trying to make psychedelics and marijuana into FDA-approved prescription medicines. And I think that's really the way we'll educate a culture that's scared, that sees things in more cultural symbols, drugs, psychedelics as cultural symbols, loses the potential, or is scared of the potential for benefits. There's going to be, I think, a tremendous amount of interest in how these substances can be used in a beneficial way. And so we are trying to raise the funds, conduct the research, design the whole strategy to move through the scientific system things that have to do both with therapeutic and also spiritual mystical experiences, to really bring science and mysticism together, science and therapy together, and at the end come out with a system of regulations that control psychedelic clinics, which are spread throughout the country, like massage centers or like birthing centers or nursing homes even, or certain ways where people go to get medical procedures, that there are specially trained people in specially trained facilities all throughout America where people can have altered states in these healthy ways. First off, potential patients, then over 10 years expanding to their families maybe, and then expanding to this license system where you have your first experience with a psychedelic in one of these safe, protected places. Then you get your license, you know what it is, you don't have an allergic reaction, then you get your license to go purchase it, use it on your own.
Now, Rick, you mentioned spirituality. I understand there are some cannabis church ministers on the West Coast going to challenge the U.S. laws for barring them from their sacrament, cannabis. The ayahuasca hearings were just a couple of weeks ago, and of course, peyote is legal for the Native American church members. Your thoughts there, sir?
I think that there's a valid role that these drugs can play in personal spiritual growth. And I do think that it shouldn't necessarily require you to participate in a particular group religion. You should be able to have your own experience. Now, I think that given that I think there is that fundamental right, and that groups are working through the Supreme Court and the U.S. legal system, I think I didn't really explain very well what MAPS does. It's a slippery slope the government fears between small group that uses ayahuasca, a small group then that has this as a spiritual sacrament, and then why can't other people, individuals, make a claim that they should have similar access, or small groups of individuals. But it's different a little bit with the system of medicine. It's a little bit more controlled, and it's also more scientific, and so that's where MAPS really is focused on two different things. We have a study in Charleston, South Carolina, with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. It's halfway done, and it's turning out great. We're getting very promising results. And we've got permission just last week in Israel for another with survivors of war and terrorism-related post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think we've got a good chance, very good chance, of getting approved in Spain in about 6 months, in Switzerland in about a month, month and a half for other studies. So we're internationalizing the research and trying to do a sequence of studies in Europe and in also in the United States for MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. And we've also got permission from the FDA and are waiting and expect soon to have DEA permission to do a study at Harvard Medical School with MDMA in advanced stage cancer patients with anxiety. So looking again at working and helping people deal with end-of-life issues. And we're in the midst of a lawsuit against DEA where we're seeking a license. We're seeking to sponsor a researcher at UMass Amherst, Professor Lyle Craker, in an effort to establish a growing facility to grow marijuana for medical research, to break the government monopoly on supply, and really to help resolve the medical marijuana issue through science and unblock the political obstructions that people are now getting, unfortunately, more familiar with the political intrusion on the FDA about Plan B, the morning after pill, and how politics has really started to pervert the FDA focus on science and really replace it with other concerns that are shouldn't be there. So that's a long way to answer from your question about religious use. I think that thousands of years of use by millions of people have shown that these things can play a role in spiritual development. The Good Friday experiment, which was done in 1962, looking at divinity students going into church on Good Friday, half placebo, half psilocybin, and looking whether they had spiritual experiences, which mostly the people with psilocybin did. I think there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it, and everybody should have that right. And that's really what we're fighting to, the right for people to explore themselves, explore their consciousness, explore their spirituality for themselves in a responsible way, and the culture should permit that. So that's what the conference was about. And also that all these compassion to harm reduction approaches really do stand a good chance of reducing the problems, because there's no solution that's going to solve all the problems inherently. Drugs are powerful substances.
You say you've been at this for 20 years approximate, and the government has tried every way possible to stonewall the research and the studies. Is that changing?
It is. It is. I mean, I actually decided to be a psychedelic therapist back in 1972. And, I didn't really start political work because I was just too isolated and uncertain and confused for like another 10 years. The research that the government was so fearful of, in the 70s, was anything positive about psychedelics because it was so wrapped up with this counterculture. Also, at the time, though, the things that came from the psyche, from the psychedelic research, were so astonishing. The whole question about spirituality, the whole issue about creativity. People don't realize that the double helix, DNA, the discovery of Francis Crick has this vision of the double helix in 1953, and later Crick and Watson win the Nobel Prize for that. Revolutionizes everything. Turns out, 1943, Albert Hoffman invents LSD. 49, it started to be used in the United States. It was used in Europe before that and after that. People got the idea it could help creativity, low doses in particular, and Francis Crick was using it. And on that particular day that he had the vision of the double helix, he was using LSD. So there's this way in which this culture can benefit tremendously from looking at things in a different way, from integrating altered states. And I think that if you just look at it culturally, we've come a very long way. And the research is starting again. And I think that it's going to continue. And I don't think we're going to have the same backlash. I don't think that we don't consider ourselves counterculture. We are really trying to work within the structures. We're trying to do stuff at Harvard to show, in a way, clearly that we've learned the lessons from Timothy Leary and others. We're at least trying to do that, and I think we'll have a good chance of succeeding at that. In the 50s, the culture was really, if you talked about yoga, if you talked about meditation, you were considered a nut. Everybody talks about yoga and meditation now. Mindfulness, relaxation. Back then, if my dad, this is the best example. I was born in 1953. My father is a pediatrician. And they did not let the fathers, even doctors, into the delivery room. And there was just, similarly, death, you didn't talk about it. So we've done a lot in our culture in the last 50 years to integrate birth, integrate death, integrate meditation and yoga and all these other things. Don't seem so weird. And so now I think we're ready for not just when psychedelics goes wrong, but what do we do when psychedelics go right? And when we start showing we can use this in the treatment of addiction, that these altered states are powerful and valuable, and that there's something inherently curiosity-seeking in the human mind to look at things in different ways. That urge can't be stopped. We're an aberration, our culture, and that gives me hope. It'll end, and it's ending, and the culture needs it. The DEA people need it. Talking about MDMA for post-traumatic stress, we may be able to help people coming back from Iraq. With the Cancer Project, we can help people who are dying. We can help a lot of people through difficult things, through these substances, approached in a wise way. So that's what we're trying to at least demonstrate. And hopefully more and more we're getting permission and people are seeing the failure of the drug war, but they're too scared. They don't know what to do next. And so we have to develop structures of regulatory control for these altered states, and that will give people hope that, yes, there's something other than just driving this into the criminal underground. There's some way that we can bring it up without it spiraling out of control. It's already out of control.
Once again, that was Dr. Rick Doblin, the president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Their website is maps.org. As it turns out, we've got time to file a couple of reports from the Drug Truth Network staff.
This is Phil Smith of the Drug War Chronicle with this week's Corrupt Cop Story for the Drug Truth Network. This week we're going to sunny Miami, Florida, where Miami police officer David Lee Donaldson is now under investigation for selling confidential information to drug dealers, after one convicted dealer told authorities Donaldson had been doing so for years. The convicted drug dealer approached police with his story in February, and then police wired him up for a meeting with Donaldson at Miami's Flagler Dog Racing Track. The dealer told Donaldson he needed two license plates for him because someone had taken cocaine from him and owed him $30,000. The cooperative Donaldson reported back that he couldn't find the plates in question, but the dealer paid Donaldson $200 for his troubles, and that was enough for Miami police to swoop. Officer Donaldson now faces up to 15 years in prison on charges of unlawful compensation, otherwise known as bribery. As always, there are more corrupt cop stories this week. Check them out online at www.stopthedrugwar.org.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
Where in the world does black market heroin come from? Southeast Asia and Latin America modestly contribute to global supply, but according to the United Nations, U.S. occupied Afghanistan, which is about the same size as President Bush's home state of Texas, now produces more than 6.5 times more illegal heroin than the rest of the world combined. Opium production has been called the backbone of Afghanistan's economy, its main engine of economic growth, and the strongest bond among its previously quarrelsome populations. An estimated 60% of U.S. Afghanistan's income comes from illegal opium production. Despite the enormous value of the crop to world black markets, worth as much as $0.3 trillion U.S. dollars, the farmers of Afghanistan make only about one penny on that dollar, the lion's share of profits realized out of country. Afghanistan is desperately poor. An estimated 70% of the population lives on less than $2 per day. New figures from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime show a 17-fold increase in heroin consumption since 1990 in Afghanistan's northern neighboring Central Asian countries. 70 to 80% of new HIV cases in this region are now reported to be injecting heroin consumers. Former U.S. Drug Czar spokesman Robert Weiner stated last week that President Bush has chosen not to pursue curbing the Afghan opium trade because U.S. troop resources are stretched to an extreme level. Former U.S. State Department Afghanistan Policy Officer Chris Mason wrote last week in the Los Angeles Times that opium, warlords, and radical Islamism are blending into what he calls a perfect storm. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, police have reported that the level of heroin seizures is now 8 times higher than those for cocaine. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Mexican officials claim a success in the war on drugs, with a side note. although the arrest of Ricardo Garcia Arquiza, a surgeon nicknamed the Doctor and the heir of the Juarez cartel, was a great blow to the war on drugs, others are saying he is not that significant. I can think of 15 people who are bigger players. And this while the homicide rate is still in double digits in Jalisco and Nuevo Laredo. The streets run red from the blood money of businesses enforcing their market share by black market rules. As their politicians give more U.S.-backed fuel, the fire of prohibition just keeps getting hotter under their feet. Ricardo is not even listed on the Attorney General's website listing Mexico's most wanted traffickers. Whatever the case, drug gang bosses have come and gone in Mexico over the past 3 decades, and the northbound flow of drugs and violence has continued. A drop in the bucket, to a bucket in the tub, to a tub in the... Well, you get my point. I have a question for our drug warriors. One down, and how many to go until we have a drug-free America and Mexico? This is Steve Nolan for the Drug Truth Network.
Couple of program notes. I wanted to let you know that I'm headed to Vancouver and to Seattle to talk to a lot of folks, to visit a lot of medical facilities, and to build some great shows for the Drug Truth Network for the holiday season. Hopefully our reporters will get settled back in. We'll get regular reports from all of them once again. I miss their keen observations. So what's the drug war all about? It's for the children, right? So here to speak on that subject from Students for Sensible Drug Policy, this is Mr. Tom Angel.
I am the campaigns director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, or SSDP. And SSDP is a growing network of students on college and high school campuses all around the country who are tired of having this harmful war on drugs waged in our names. For too long, politicians have said, what about the children? We need to have these harsh drug policies to protect young people. But students are increasingly saying that drug policies are actually putting us at greater harm and aren't protecting us at all by taking away our access to education and giving us misleading drug information as opposed to accurate education.
On the other side of that, Tom, if I dare say, the millions of parents who have not been in the home because they were swept up by these drug laws has been a major detriment to progress as well, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, while there are a number of drug policies that directly target young people, like the financial aid ban for drug offenses and student drug testing, it's important to remember that young people are often swept up as collateral damage in the drug war. When a parent is incarcerated, a young person often has to go live with a foster family and isn't able to visit with their parents except through glass or over the phone. And then when the parent gets out of prison, that parent is often unable to get food stamps or access to public housing or education. And so, you know, there are long and short-term negative consequences that come down onto young people because of these drug policies.
Now, Tom, as I understand it, your organization is trying to change the laws which prevent students from getting a loan if they've had any type of drug arrest.
That's right. Due to a 1998 amendment to the Higher Education Act, students who are convicted on drug charges will automatically lose their federal financial aid. And we think that this is something that is absolutely insane. If we are really trying to reduce our drug abuse problems in this country, why would we want to put up roadblocks on the path to education and recovery? And so we've been lobbying Congress for the past 7 years. Students all around the country have been meeting with and calling on their legislators to do something about this and to reinstate financial aid to our peers who are trying to move on with their lives after brushes with the law. And we're getting close to the point where Congress is about to make some changes to the law and actually scale it back and reinstate financial aid to some students who've been affected by this policy. Unfortunately, right now it looks like that Congress is only going to make a partial reform to the law, and tens of thousands of students will unfortunately be left behind.
Earlier you mentioned the impact, how it changes a person's life, their possibilities, if they are arrested for drugs. And when a person's in college, that's a time when many people do experiment with these drugs, and some colleges have better means of going about this than others. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, we've seen a trend around the country of campuses enacting harsher and harsher drug policies that are actually putting students at greater risk. So instead of handling drug matters internally with counseling and treatment, more and more schools are actually calling the cops on students and having them rifle through their dorm rooms, which results in students being sent to court and being at risk of receiving convictions, which would make them lose their financial aid and their access to education altogether. Colleges and universities are supposed to educate students and help them become productive, taxpaying citizens. However, more and more we're seeing colleges act as entities of the drug war, the prison industrial complex, and putting students at greater risk of losing their financial aid or being incarcerated. And so SSDP now is in the process of formulating a campaign to help students who want to work to change bad drug policies on their campuses. We as young people are actually in a position to use our campuses as laboratories for experimenting for what a sensible drug policy actually looks like. We're the young people, and we're going to be living with the disastrous effects of the drug war for the rest of our lives. So it's up to us to figure out more sensible and rational and humane ways to deal with the complex issue of drug abuse and addiction. And if the more and more we can work on the campus level, hopefully that'll branch out to the city and state and then eventually federal levels. And so we feel like students have a real opportunity to create sensible drug policies on their own campuses. SSDP's website is online at www.ssdp.org, and students can go there to find out how to start a chapter or get involved with existing chapters.
You know, I try each week to entice additional affiliates to join the Drug Truth Network. We still pick up one or two affiliates each month, but I'd like to reach all of America with this truth. So now I'm trying to negotiate with a few program directors and some small syndicates to rearrange the show a bit to tweak out offensive things like my editorials. I promised a cease and desist on calling ignorant, greedy, and twisted drug warriors names like coward, corporate whores, or even evil bastards. But the further I dig into this century of lies, the more I examine the wreckage of this drug war, the more I realize my statements are not editorials at all. My attitude is not one of recklessness, nor am I unwilling to present the truths from the drug warriors. I've spent more than 10,000 hours investigating the subject of drug prohibition with hundreds of very knowledgeable people, judges, congressmen, scientists. You've heard them here on the Drug Truth Network, and each and every one has given me confidence in my stance taken. However, I want those programmers and the syndicates out there to know that I'll not hold back for one second from telling the glaring and so very obvious truth. Evil is as evil does. Well, that about does it for this edition of Cultural Baggage. I hope you'll visit our website, which is drugtruth.net. And to really get in tune with drug reform, please hook up at inprohibition.org. And of course, for any of you certified or civilian drug warriors out there who'd like to earn a few bucks, be sure to get in touch with me, Dean at drugtruth.net. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of none of this.